All right. Good morning, everyone. And we thank everyone for attending today's course entitled 2021 Deadlines Every IRA Holder Should Know. Again, thank you for attending today's course entitled 2021 Deadlines Every IRA Holder, Whatever IRA Holder Should Know. My name is John Paul Ruiz. I'm the Director of Professional Development here at the N-Trust Group, and I will be your instructor for today's webinar. Just before we get started, a little bit of housekeeping. N-Trust Group does not provide investment advice or endorse any products. Everything that we present in this particular webinar is purely for informational purposes. Again, all information and materials are for educational purposes only. All parties are always encouraged to consult with their attorneys, accountants, and financial advisors before entering into any type of investment, or if you have any sort of tax questions, we'll refer you to your competent tax or legal advisor. Now, for the agenda for this course, we're going to talk a little bit about the N-Trust Group, since we are the one providing the course. We're going to talk about what we do, what is a self-directed IRA, the benefits of self-direction, and then we'll dive into the material. The material will last approximately half hour to 40 minutes long, and then we'll open up the lines for any questions you may have in regards to the material presented. I take that back. Instead of opening up the lines, you can type in your questions, and then we will read your questions, and hopefully we'll be able to answer everybody's questions since there are quite a number of people attending this seminar today. All right. Again, my name is John Paul Ruiz, Director of Professional Development here at the N-Trust Group. Not only do we educate our clients at the N-Trust Group, we also have what we call the IRA Academy. The IRA Academy is a preparatory course for individuals who would like to attain what we call the Certified IRA Services Professional Designation through the American Banking Association. So we do have an approved class for that, for practitioners or retirement professionals that want to get that particular designation. Again, we do have what we call the IRA Academy that not only educates our staff, but also educates the industry. A little bit about the N-Trust Group. Now, the N-Trust Group has been around for over 39 years in the self-directed world. And we have about $400 billion of assets under management, about 22,000 accounts. And one of the main differences that we delineate ourselves from the rest is that you do have a point of contact. In other words, you can actually speak to people in regards to any questions you may have in regards to your account. Of course, we will always reserve the right to say, we can't answer that question because that's a legal or tax question, but we can definitely give you the general rules to help you even formulate the questions that you have for your tax or legal advisor to be able to navigate through the journey of having what we call a self-directed IRA. Now, the N-Trust Group is what we call a self-directed IRA administrator. In other words, what we do is offer the components of being able to establish a retirement plan through a certified consultant, or in other words, an eligible entity, not consultant, but an eligible entity. In other words, in an IRA, under the Internal Revenue Code 408, IRAs can only be established at trust companies, banks, credit unions, and the N-Trust Group has an affiliate, which is another company that the same owners own. It's called the N-Trust Trust Company out of Nashville, Tennessee, that basically custodies or hold the assets of what we call a self-directed IRA. The entity that's providing the seminar today is a record-keeping shop. The assets under the custody of what we call the N-Trust Trust Company has to be record-kept. In other words, there has to be some sort of entity that conducts all of the necessary IRS reporting requirements, such as your 1099-Rs, 5498s, as well as provide, as an example, availability of the information under your account through an internet portal. that's the Entrust administration group, which is providing this particular course today. The staff that services your IRA are very knowledgeable. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we do have what we call the IRA Academy that educates individuals in the industry to sit for what we call the CISP designation, or the Certified IRA Service Professional designation through the American Banking Banking Association. We do have nationwide offices, not all over, not all 50 states, but they're regionally located in four parts of the United States: West Coast, the Midwest, as well as the East Coast. And for some reason that you would like to have a group listen to one of our speakers to provide more education about the world of self-direction, we'd be more than happy to send one of our business development managers to make a presentation for your group. We do have, again, the IRA Academy is can be used for continuing education credits for a lot of the nationwide designations, including but not limited to the IRS Enrolled Actuaries designation, as well as enrolled agents, not enrolled actuaries, but enrolled agents. Hard to speak this morning for some reason. As well as the Certified Financial Planner Board. We also have additional designations through the American Banking Association that could potentially get CE credits for these courses that we provide. Along with that, some realtors also use some of our courses as continuing education for their real estate licenses, so on and so forth. Again, we provide education for in-person events as well as webinars. Now, let's dive into the material. Enough of us. Let's dive into the material. Wouldn't you believe it? It's already 2021, and we felt that it was important for you, the IRA holder or retirement plan holder, to understand what there are some significant deadlines in 2021 that may or may not affect you, depending upon the type of transactions that you conducted in 2020, as well as are about to conduct in 2021. And that's why we created this course, 2001 deadlines that IRA holders should know about in the event that you're not aware of some of these, how some of these transactions are facilitated in your tax return, as well as, you know, you may be wondering what type of forms will I receive if I receive this form from the IRS in 2021? What do I do with it? And that's what this particular course is about. All right. Let's start off on January 31st. And for January 31st, here are some of the deadlines that you may be receiving. If you took a distribution in 2020, the IRS requires the administrator or the custodian, in this case, the administrator, because we perform the ministerial duties on behalf of the custodian, the Entrust Trust Company, that if you took a distribution from your IRA, we must report the amount of the distribution to the IRS. If it's taxable, a specific code that will show up on box 7 will show the type of distribution that was taken from an IRA. That form is what we call the IRS Form 1099-R. If you receive an IRS Form 1099-R, that means that an amount came out of your IRA. Whether or not it's taxable or not will be dependent upon the code that is on box 7 of this form. You may want to consult with your tax advisor in regards to how to handle the amount coming out of your IRA on your tax return if it so happens that an amount may be reportable as taxable income. On January 31st, another document must be provided by the administrator to an IRA holder, and that's what we call the fair market value statement. If anybody has a balance on their account by December 31st, not just IRA holders, but also beneficiaries of individuals who have passed away that kept the assets that they've inherited under what we call an inherited IRA, you must receive a fair market value statement. Again, the fair market value statement should report the amount that is left in an individual's IRA on December 31st. One of the reasons why they also require a fair market value statement is that individuals who may have contributed to IRAs in the past are not required to continually make a contribution to those IRAs that they've contributed to in previous years. So therefore, as a reminder to the IRA holder that they still have a balance in that particular IRA, a fair market value is required for the administrator of the IRA to provide this particular statement to the IRA holder. Now, along the same lines of January 31st, there's also another requirement to provide what we call a required minimum distribution statement. In other words, if an IRA holder is required to take a distribution in the year that this particular statement is created, in other words, if somebody has an RMD for 2021, since the formula requires to use the prior year-end balance, in other words, the December 31st, 2020 balance to calculate the RMD for 2021, administrators are required to provide this statement to IRA holders are required to take a required minimum distribution of the amount of the RMD that they're supposed to distribute from their IRA or offer to calculate the amount that must be distributed from their IRA for the particular tax year. In this case, the tax year that we're looking at is 2021. Again, in 2021, if a person has an RMD, that required minimum distribution statement must be provided to the IRA holder. Now, some financial institutions combine the two. In other words, within their fair market value statement, they may include the required minimum distribution statement, and that's okay. So watch out for that if you are over age 70 and a half in previous years, but moving forward, be age 72. In other words, if you've already started taking required minimum distributions, this is the statement you need to take a look at. Because either you will find the RMD that you're supposed to distribute for that particular year, or there's a reminder in there that if you do need assistance on calculating your required minimum distribution, you can approach the financial institution. Now, some institutions choose one method over the other, but both are correct. So if you don't get an amount and you need assistance in acquiring that amount, just give your IRA administrator a call. And if you're an interest client, please give us a call and we'll be more than happy to assist you in calculating that required minimum distribution that is due on a yearly basis. All right. Now, this form again is due. These forms are due by January 31st. However, if any tax act, such as providing a tax form to an IRA holder, falls on a weekend or a holiday, then the deadline is the following business day. So for 2021, the deadline is February 1st. So this is just a significant date on when 1099-R should be shipped out. For some who are interest clients, you can actually go to your portal and you may be able to acquire or retrieve this information once it's made available to your account at the interest group. Again, as we go through this particular part of the presentation, if you have any questions, jot those down on a piece of paper and later on, we'll be more than happy to respond to your questions regards to the material presented. All right. On the 1099-R, 1099-R series forms again sent out to the IRA holders by typically January 31st, but again, if it falls on a weekend or a holiday, then it's the following business day. It does report not only taxable distributions, but it also reports non-taxable distributions. Again, that's why the code on box 7 is very important. So if you see a code R, that may be what we call a recharacterization. That's not taxable. Or if you receive a 1099-R with a code G from a 401k plan, a 403b, or governmental 457b plan, you know, that you initiated a direct rollover from that plan into an IRA, that's code G. If you have a designated Roth account and those plans that are rolled over into a Roth account, that's a code H. Those are just examples of the codes. Again, consult with your tax advisor to determine whether or not the transaction that is reported under 1099-R under your name and Social Security number is taxable or not. Then from there, they can advise you appropriately on how to report that in the tax return. All right. Now, there's also this box called Box 4 on an IRS Form 1099-R. It's called Federal Income Tax Withheld. Anytime an individual takes a distribution out of an IRA that is taxable, in other words, the administrator already knows that the distribution is taxable, or it could be subject to tax, there must be what we call an automatic withholding, or in other words, an amount taken out of the distribution and set aside and sent to Uncle Sam. That amount is shown on box 4. The amount that is required under section 3405 of the Internal Revenue Code is a minimum of 10%. An individual cannot ever withhold less than 10% because the minimum is 10%. However, an individual could say, you know what, I have enough withholding from other taxable income that I have that I should have enough withheld or set money set aside to pay the tax towards this distribution, and an individual could actually waive out of it. That is done through what we call an IRS form W-4P. So if you have ever filled out a distribution form from a financial institution, they typically have what we call the W-4P or substitute W-4P embedded in that distribution form. If you don't waive out of it, an automatic 10% will be withheld from that distribution. So if you're taking a distribution of 100, then 10% or $100 would automatically be withheld from that. $10, $100, 10%, $10 will be withheld from that, and your check would only be for $90. Unless, of course, you ask for the custodian or the administrator to withhold more than 10%, which is possible. Some individuals could also say that I don't have enough withholding to pay the tax on this distribution. I would like to have more set aside. You can go up to 100% if you really wanted to. That amount is again is shown on box 4 of the IRS form 1099-R. This form is filed with your tax return if you have something on box 4, because that's the only way the IRS would know how much has been taken out of a distribution and set aside towards the prepayment of the potential tax that you would owe for a particular distribution. Now, keep in mind, this amount that's withheld does not mean that your tax has been paid, because depending upon the tax bracket that you're in, the amount that's been withheld from that distribution may not be enough to pay towards the tax liability of such distribution. The IRS, actually Congress, through the IRS, just mandates 10% withheld. However, if you're in the 22% tax bracket, as an example, that obviously the 10% that you've withheld is not enough. How do you know how much to withhold on a particular distribution? That's where your tax advisor comes in, because they'll be able to tell you what marginal tax rate you belong to or where this particular distribution will fall to make sure that you withhold enough for the taxes for the distribution when the payment is required when you file your tax return. Now, keep in mind, we're just talking about the federal tax. There may also be a state income tax that is associated with your distribution. That, again, is where the tax advisor will come into play in regards to the state tax that could also be owed for the particular distribution. Again, that is all reported on an IRS form 1099-R. Fair market value statement, again, reports the December 31st balance of an individual's account. This amount is actually also used for RMD calculation for the year in which this fair market value statement is produced. The amount may come from the IRA holder in most cases in a self-directed account. It has to come from the IRA holder because there are some investments that an IRA holder may have chosen that requires additional assistance from other entities to provide the market value, such as an appraisal or a property tax bill from the county, the general partner from a partnership, or the general manager from an LLC. Again, the fair market value statement must be accurate. Not only must it be provided, but it must also be accurate. But if it comes from the IRA holder, then it's the IRA holder's responsibility to make sure that the correct fair market value is provided to the IRA administrator or custodian. All right. And last but not least, again, the required minimum distribution statement is required under Notice 2002-27. It is due to the IRA holder by January 31st. However, if it falls on a weekend or a holiday, then that deadline is February 1st. Again, it assists IRA holders that have required minimum distributions or to notify them that they have a required minimum distribution due for that particular year. All right. The required minimum distribution statement, again, falls under one of two methods. Number one is to provide an actual amount to the individual and to tell the individual when it's actually due. And number two, if they choose this method, if the financial institution chooses this method, then the financial institution just provides a specific date on when the RMD is due, and as well as offer to calculate the IRA holder in the event that the IRA holder needs assistance. March 15th, let's move on to March 15th. March 15th is the deadline for S corporations as well as the partnership tax deadline. Why is this significant? Because March 15th on a calendar year, fiscal tax year for an employer is the deadline on when S corporations and partnership tax returns must be filed. This is also the deadline to establish as well as contribute to what we call a simplified employee pension plan. In other words, it's a profit sharing plan for an employer that they could establish, and the contributions go into what we call a traditional IRA, called a SEP contribution. The maximum contribution for 2020, why are we talking about 2020? Because the contribution being made in March 15 is for tax year 2020. The maximum contribution is $57,000 for 2020. If an entrepreneur that does not have any rank and file employees, in other words, the only employees that that a business may have is, are owners, well, a individual 401k plan may also be something that may be feasible or something that may be something you want to consider. In an individual 401k plan, it can not only be established by the tax return due date of an employer, they can also contribute on behalf of that employer's tax return to an employer plan by their tax return deadline. That amount, again, is used for as a tax deduction on their tax returns. In other words, if you made a certain amount of dollars, wouldn't it be nice to take a portion of that, contribute it to your retirement plan, and use that as a tax deduction on your tax return? If you want to learn more about SEPs and individual 401k plans, attend one of our courses that deal with that particular topic, or go to IRS Publication 560. Publication 560 is the IRS publication that explains the three different types of employer plans. One of them is what we call the SEP plan. We've talked about that. The qualified retirement plan, which an individual 401k plan is what we call a qualified retirement plan. And last but not least, a simple plan. A simple plan has a specific deadline that is not associated with the tax return due date plus extensions of an employer. So therefore, that's why you don't see that in this particular slide. Again, the maximum SEP plan contribution for 2020 is $57,000. And for 401k plans, it's in addition to the profit sharing contribution, there may also be what we call a deferral. So in other words, if an employer only makes, if an employer makes 100 grand and the maximum SEP plan contribution is the lesser of 25% of compensation, not to exceed $57,000, well, 25% of that compensation is only 25 grand. So therefore, above and beyond the 25 grand, an employer could also contribute what we call a deferral, which is $19,500 for 2020. In other words, unlike the SEP plan, contributions are a lot larger in a 401k plan. You might want to consult with your tax advisor if that's something of interest to you in regards to potentially establishing this type of plan for tax year 2020. April 15th is a significant date for every American. Why is that? Because that's the tax return due date for an individual to file their tax return if you do have taxable income. Now, for some people who do not make more than a certain dollar figure, they may not be required to file a tax return. However, if you do want a tax refund of the amounts withheld from your paychecks, even though you're not supposedly, liable for any tax, if you want a refund for that, you still have to file a tax return. That deadline is April 15th. Now, if April 15th falls on a weekend or a holiday, then the following day is the deadline, right? The April 15th is also the deadline to make your own individual annual IRA contribution. This deadline does not include extensions. So in other words, April 15th is the drop-dead date to make a contribution to a traditional IRA, the annual contribution to a traditional IRA, or as well as a Roth IRA. However, above and beyond your annual contribution, if you wanted to make a what we call an employer contribution, which is your SEP or individual 401k plan, this April 15th is the deadline for other types of entities, such as your sole proprietors or Schedule C filers, or C corporations. So if you're a C corp or a sole proprietor, the deadline is April 15th to file your return, right? April 15th is also the initial deadline to recharacterize a current year contribution that you've made from one type of IRA to be moved to another type of IRA. What does that mean? If, let's say, you made an annual contribution to your traditional IRA, assuming that you were going to be able to use it as a tax deduction. However, when you filed your tax return, you determined that the contribution made to the traditional IRA cannot be used as a tax deduction. You have an alternative option, and that is to move it to a Roth if you're eligible for it. The movement for the annual contribution from a traditional to a Roth is what we call a recharacterization. The deadline to move your current year contribution from one type of IRA to another type of IRA is the tax return due date of an individual plus extensions. Well, the tax return due date for individuals is April 15th. So this is the initial deadline for those individuals who would like to recharacterize their contribution from one type of IRA to another type of IRA. In other circumstances, another use of recharacterizations is if an individual made a contribution to the Roth, and of course the Roth has maximum income requirements, or maximum income levels that will determine whether or not they are eligible to contribute to a Roth. If an individual contributes too much, then they're not eligible to contribute to the Roth. Well, what's the option, the alternative approach? You can either take it out, or actually you can actually move it to a traditional IRA and still make that traditional IRA contribution. The only thing that may be affected is that the contribution may not be deductible. So for all intents and purposes, recharacterizations have many purposes, and the deadline to do that is April 15th. April 15th, again, is the deadline to make a contribution, to establish a SEP or individual 401k plan for a sole proprietor or C corporations. Again, a look at publication 560 for more information on these types of employer plans. And last but not least, April 15th is the deadline to recharacterize a current year contribution. Now, contributions are reported on a particular form called the IRS Form 5498. The IRS Form 5498 is used to report contributions to IRAs, as well as it may also be used to report contributions to another type of plan called an HSA. And that is what we call a 5498SA. These forms are due to be sent to the IRS and the IRA holder by May 31st. Again, if May 31st falls on a weekend or a holiday, then the deadline falls on the next following business day. June 1st. June 1st is the deadline to remove an excess education savings account contribution. In other words, if an individual made a contribution to a designated beneficiary, in other words, a minor's education savings account, and that individual is also the responsible individual, in other words, the person that can act on behalf of the minor, to remove an education savings account excess contribution, the deadline is June 1st. June 1st is the deadline to remove an excess on what we call an education savings account. September 15th. September 15th is the deadline for S-Corps as well as partnerships that file for what we call a tax return extension. Employers who have a complicated tax return may ask for a little bit more time to file their tax return. As you may recall, March 15 is the deadline for S-Corporations as well as partnerships to file their tax return. However, if they apply for what we call an extension, the IRS automatically gives them 6 months, and that lands on September 15th. So if an S-Corp or a partnership filed for an extension, that buys them a little bit of time to not only make a contribution for their employer plan, but it also allows for those types of entities who do not have an employer plan to establish a SEP, an individual 401k plan for tax year 2020. Now, again, this only is for S corporations and partnerships. The deadline, again, is September 15th if they filed for a tax return extension. Now, October 1st. October 1st has significant deadlines for an employer that would like to establish a simple plan, a simple IRA plan for tax year 2020. Since all simple plans plans operate on a calendar year, in other words, January 1st to December 31st, and one of the main components of contributions for a simple plan is what we call an employee deferral. In other words, it comes from their paycheck. It has to be deducted from their paycheck. The deadline is October 1st to establish a brand new plan for an existing employer for tax year 2021. So if an employer would like to have a simple plan and they've never had a plan before and they're an existing employer, they want to establish a simple plan. Number one, they must provide a notice to all employees prior to October 1st, 60 days prior to October 1st. And the deadline to sign the simple plan document, along with the custodian that they've chosen, where the simple IRAs are going to be established to receive the contribution, must be signed by October 1st of 2021. Now, what if an employer is not established until after October 1st? Well, the regulations say, which is Notice 98-4. If you want to Google it, go ahead. It's Notice 98-4. It says that employers that are established after October 1st may establish the plan as soon as administratively feasible. In other words, as soon as they can. Right. You may be asking, why October 1st? Given the fact that one of the main components or contributions to a simple plan are what we call employee deferrals. Imagine if the employer says, we're not going to establish the plan until December 31st. Well, how in the world are you going to take money out of an individual's paychecks when it's already been paid to the employees if you say that the plan is established on December 31st? So the IRS basically put at least what we call a short plan year, at least 3 months for the employees to be able to take money out of their paychecks and contribute to the plan if an employer is establishing a simple plan for a particular tax year. That short plan year is basically October 1st. In other words, by October 1st, there must be a plan so that the remaining portion of the year, the participants can actually contribute out of their own paycheck. In other words, a cash or deferred arrangement to contribute to that simple plan. All right, moving right along. Another deadline in October is what we call the tax return due date extension for sole proprietors and C-Corps. And that tax return due date is October 15th. Why is that? Because as you recall, April 15th is the tax return deadline for sole proprietors and C-Corps. If they apply for an extension, physically apply for an extension, well, then those entities will be given a six-month extension. And the date in which that 6 month falls under is October 15th. So again, C-Corps as well as sole proprietors file for tax return extension, their deadline to contribute an employer plan for tax year 2020 is extended to October 15th. As well as employers who do not have a plan for 2020, not only can they contribute, they can also actually establish the plan by their tax return due date plus extensions. And again, if it falls under sole proprietor C Corp, then their tax return due date extension would fall on October 15th. I hope you're writing questions down because we are going to hopefully try to answer your questions that you may have in regards to the material presented. October 15th deadline for 401k plan establishment is pretty new. That basically came about because of the Secure Act. The Secure Act of 2019, made effective 2020, allows for an employer to establish an individual 401k plan up until the tax return due date plus extensions. And this is new. So if the tax advisor says, I thought the deadline was the end of the fiscal tax year of the employer, well, that has been changed because of the Secure Act. The Secure Act allows for an employer to establish and contribute to a 401k plan up until the tax return due date plus extensions of that employer. All right. October 31st, if you have a simple plan, financial institutions must provide the employer a letter stating that if you need the forms to provide your notices to your employees by the first 60 days prior to the initial date of the new plan year, that these documents can be provided to the employer. In other words, before the beginning of a plan year, employees must elect whether or not they want to participate or not participate in a simple plan. And one of the incentives to participate in a simple plan is the mandatory employer contribution. An employer could contribute either one of the two employer contributions. One is what we call a match. In other words, if an employee puts in a dollar, the employer puts in a dollar as well. It's a matching contribution. It's 100% dollar for dollar match up to 3% of the individual's compensation. So in other words, if an employee defers 10% of their paycheck, well, the employer will only match up to 3% of their compensation. That gives an incentive for an employee to participate in a simple plan, because if you don't participate, well, they don't get a match. Another mandatory contribution an employer could choose is what we call a non-elective contribution, which is what we call a profit-sharing contribution. This is not very popular among employers, because whether or not an individual participates in a simple via what we call a deferral contribution, that employee must still receive whatever the employer elected if they choose to elect what we call the non-elective contribution, because it's a profit-sharing contribution. They must receive at least a 2% profit-sharing contribution, regardless of whether or not they defer into the plan. That's why it's not as popular as what we call the matching contribution. For a matching contribution, the employee must defer a portion of their paycheck in order for them to receive the match. The October 31st deadline is significant because a lot of employers do not have the forms to provide to their employees what type of contribution they're choosing for the upcoming calendar year. Therefore, they must rely on somebody else to get that form from. And that's where your IRA administrators that basically provided the simple document to the employer has that responsibility if the employer needs it. So October 31st is the deadline, so that the employer can satisfy the November 2nd, drop that date to notify their employees. November 2nd is 60 days prior to the beginning of the following plan year. So in other words, by October 31st, whoever the custodian is or the administrator is must provide that document to the employer. If the employer needs that document, November 1st, if they receive it, then they can elect what type of contribution they're choosing to make for the following calendar year. And then from there, hopefully the employer provided it by November 2nd, which is 60 days prior to the beginning of the prior plan year, of whether or not the employee would like to participate in the plan or not, depending upon the type of employer contribution the employer may have chosen to contribute for that particular year. Again, it's one of the two, match or non-elected contribution. To find out more about simple plans, there is a notice 98-4 that you could Google, as well as publication 560. And those documents are important so that you have a little bit of understanding of how these plans work, so that as you approach your tax or legal advisor in discussing whether or not this is a good plan for you, as if you're an employer, it's good to equip yourself with that information. All right. November 2nd, again, is the deadline for businesses to provide the notices to their employees of the type of contribution they're going to be making for the following upcoming plan year. And it should either be a match or non-elective contribution. November 12th, this is specifically for NTRUST clients. NTRUST sends a fair market valuation notification to all clients to remind them that they have to send us the fair market value of the assets under their IRA, so that we can put that amount into their accounts so that we can report that to the IRS. Because remember, again, December 31st value of an individual's IRA is reported to the IRS as well as the IRA holder. And that information comes from the IRA holder. All right. So that November 12th is a specific NTRUST deadline or a specific date where NTRUST will require for the fair market value of their IRA. Ah, we're approaching the end of this particular presentation. Now we're December 31st. December 31st is the deadline in which IRA holders who are taking their second or prospectively RMDs that are due after they've turned a significant date. In other words, for people who have turned over 17.5 in prior years, the deadline to distribute their RMD is December 31st. However, if an individual who turned 70 and a half in 2020 is not 72 yet, they can postpone their RMD into a later date. However, if you've already started taking your RMDs, you must continue, unfortunately, you must continue taking your RMDs. The deadline to remove your RMD is December 31st. And there is a specific deadline. Anyway, let me just put it this way. You need to notify your custodians way ahead of time to request your required minimum distribution in order for them to satisfy the drop dead date of December 31st. Because it does take a little bit of processing to process a distribution so that it does come out of the IRA by the specific deadline of December 31st. So make sure that you notify your custodians ahead of time if you have an RMD. All right. For individuals who have passed away, IRA holders that have passed away, their beneficiaries must establish their inherited accounts by December 31st of 2021. In other words, if an inheritor of an individual's IRA who is deceased would like to keep the assets under an inherited IRA, the inherited IRA must be established by December 31st of the year following the year of death to maintain certain benefits of calculating required minimum distributions. Well, that concludes the presentation of the material. I hope you are writing questions down in regards to the dates that we have gone over. Now I'd like to turn it over to Andrew and in regards to covering what's next.
All right, so what's next is the following. If you would like to let us know what you felt about today's session or would like to suggest topics for us in the further months, we are still developing 2021 ideas, so please be a part of that. You can fill out the brief webinar survey after you exit this session. Next, we truncated today's presentation into a 2-page PDF that you can review quickly throughout the year. Please expect that in our follow-up email to you. If you have any more questions about SDIRAs outside of today's session, please visit our website or Learning Center. And of course, follow us on social to stay up to date on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And then JP, if you could go to the next slide.
Okay. Please feel free to share our Learning Center as well to any of your friends that are investors or any family members that are interested in learning more about self-direction as well. Now, we'd like to open up, we'd like to answer some of the questions you may have in regards to the materials presented. Andrew, I will turn it over to you.
Great. All right. We're going to get started here with our Q&A. So again, if you did not already have the chance to, or if you have more questions, please submit them in your chat box or questions box, and I will sort through them and we will answer them in order. All right. JP, starting with, can the RMD come from other IRAs?
That's a good question. The question again was, if an individual has an RMD from a particular IRA provider, as long as they have an amount, can they distribute that from other IRAs? The answer is yes. There is a notice issued in 1988, it's been a while, notice 8838. Notice 8838 allows for an IRA holder, as long as each IRA is calculated separately, to distribute their RMD from any IRA that they choose to distribute it from. So in other words, as an example, here's one scenario. Let's say an IRA holder has a piece of land under their retirement plan, and they don't have any cash in there. So how do you satisfy an RMD? If they have cash at another IRA, at another institution, like let's say a broker-dealer, and they would like to distribute their RMD from that IRA, they may do so. And that is what we call RMD aggregation. So in other words, they can aggregate the amount of their RMDs and distribute it from any IRA they choose to distribute it from. I hope that answers your question.
Great. Next question. What happens if I don't provide an FMV?
What happens if you don't provide an FMV? That's a good question. Well, the Article 5 of the IRA document says, number one, that the grantor of the IRA must provide a fair market value so that the custodian can actually perform their duties. And that's a part of the IRS model document called IRS Form 5305. And if it's the interest group, since we consider ourselves a custodian, that'd be a 5305A. But most custodians, including the interest group, if you don't provide a fair market value, all that we're going to do is report whatever we have in our current files. In other words, so if you don't make a change, then that same fair market value will be reported on the IRS form 5498 as well as the fair market value statement. Now, if it's incorrect in the event of an audit, then that's between the IRA holder and the IRS, because the custodian is just merely reliant upon the IRA holder to provide the correct amount, again, based on Article 5 of the IRS Form 5305A. Hope that answers your question.
Next question. Is a distribution synonymous with an investment purchase from an IRA?
Is a distribution synonymous to an investment purchase in an IRA? The answer is no. A distribution means that if assets under an IRA leave the umbrella of that IRA, so in other words, if let's say you had a direct rollover from a 401k plan to an IRA of $400,000, and that direct rollover, of course, is not taxable. However, if you took money out and had that amount made payable to yourself as an IRA holder, in other words, it left the umbrella of the IRA, any amounts that are made payable to you is considered a distribution. Every amount coming out of an IRA must be looked at and scrutinized and determined whether or not that amount is subject to taxation. Most distributions are subject to taxation, unless, of course, it's a Roth IRA. Therefore, there's a little bit more steps that an IRA holder must take in order to determine whether or not that distribution is taxable or not. And what I mean by that, because in a Roth IRA, there's what we call the ordering rules. First dollars coming out are what we call contributions. Those are not taxable nor subject to a penalty. The second layer are conversions. Conversions are the amounts converted from a traditional IRA to a Roth in a given tax year. The amount of the converted amount is taxed for that year, so there's no taxation, but could be subject to a penalty. From there, if they did touch the earnings, if the IRA holder touched the earnings, then the earnings will be taxable. So only amounts that are leaving an IRA are considered distributions. Purchasing an investment under a retirement plan all falls under the umbrella of an IRA, so therefore it's not considered a distribution. All it is that the custodian is instructed by the IRA holder to take a portion of that cash and purchase a particular investment. Similar to buying stocks, you could have cash at a broker dealer and you basically either conduct a transaction through an internet portal or contact a service representative to purchase a particular investment using cash under the retirement plan. As long as none of the investments nor the cash leaves the IRA, it's not considered as a distribution. I hope that answers your question.
Next question. Can you go over the difference between distribution, transfer, and rollover, which are taxable?
Sure. Okay. Let's go over the three different terminologies that was just mentioned: a distribution, a transfer, and a rollover. That's a good question. This is where a lot of the confusion comes into play for IRA holders. Not that it's a very difficult situation. It's just that we have a different language in the retirement industry, and a lot of IRA holders do not do this every day. So that's a very, very good question. Let's start off with a distribution. A distribution, again, is an amount leaving an individual's IRA. When an amount leaves an individual's IRA, the IRS would always ask the question, is this amount taxable? Therefore, it always requires that amount coming out of an IRA to be reported to the IRS. Just because it's reported to the IRS doesn't mean it's taxable. All right. So if an amount comes out, there are specific codes that are associated with that amount coming out that an IRA custodian or administrator would put on box 7 of the 1099-R to depict the different types of amounts coming out. The typical codes for distributions from a traditional IRA that reports an amount taxable are your code 1 and code 7. If you see code 1 or code 7, that means that the custodian is saying that, you know, we don't know about this distribution, but we're going to report it as a taxable distribution, unless, of course, the IRA holder has proof that a portion of the assets within the IRA has already been taxed. In other words, a portion of the IRA distribution are what we call non-deductible contributions. Non-deductible contributions are typically tracked on what we call an IRS Form 8606. You can Google an IRS Form 8606, familiarize yourself a little bit with it, because it does keep track of the dollars that have been taxed already in an IRA. Again, that's IRS Form 8606. In other words, let's say an individual took $100,000 out of a traditional IRA. The $100,000 will be taxable to the IRA holder unless, of course, the IRA holder completes an IRS Form 8606 depicting contributions that have been taxed in previous years, because a portion of that distribution should not be taxed. Let's say they come up with a calculation and come up with $5,000 as non-deductible contributions. What that means is that only $95,000 of the $100,000 will be taxable, because they've tracked their non-deductible contributions in an IRA. Those are what we call distributions. All right, money coming out that could be subject to tax. There are other types of distributions that are non-taxable, such as amounts coming out of an IRA that it's just being moved to another IRA, called a recharacterization. There's special codes for that. Those are what you call your code R or code N. Code R or code N. Now, I'm giving you a lot of codes, but you can actually acquire these codes by downloading the 1099-R and 5498 instructions. 1099-R and 5498 instructions. The 1099-R and 5498 instructions are the instructions used by financial institutions on what code to put down on box 7. On that instruction publication, there is a chart that tells, that depicts what each code means, all right? Code R and code N are recharacterizations. Those are not taxable to an IRA holder. But code one and code seven, and an additional code four for death distributions for inherited accounts. In other words, if a beneficiary takes a distribution, that's a code four. For Roth distributions, that'll be a code J, a Q, or a T. The J and the T may depict some taxation in it if there's any earnings being distributed. Again, the J or T has taxation. Those are distributions. Now let's move on to transfers. Okay, transfers are what we call non-taxable, non-reportable movement of assets between like plans. In other words, if you wanted to move from a traditional IRA to another traditional IRA at another financial institution, there must be an agreement between the two financial institutions that there's not going to be any sort of taxation reporting, right? And there's also going to be nothing that the IRA holder must do, because all they're doing is moving the IRA from one institution to another. And that instigation of the transfer is typically handled by the receiving institution. In other words, they're requesting from another financial institution for assets to be transferred to that financial institution. Why does the receiving institution have to instigate it? Because the other financial institution, the sending institution, will only feel comfortable sending it as a non-reportable, non-taxable transaction if, number one, the IRA that's receiving the assets of the other financial institution is the same type, and number two, that the IRA holder actually requested the transfer to occur from one financial institution to the other, all right? Again, it's a non-reportable, non-taxable transaction between like plans, from a traditional to traditional, to a Roth, from a Roth to a Roth, from a simple IRA to a simple IRA, with one exception. If an individual has a simple IRA and it has satisfied what we call the two-year rule, so in other words, from the initial contribution, 2 years has passed, that simple IRA can be transferred to a traditional IRA as if the simple IRA is a traditional IRA, but it has to satisfy that two-year rule. But nonetheless, a transfer can only happen between like plans. A Roth to a Roth, traditional to traditional, simple to simple, with one exception, the simple to traditional, as long as a two-year rule has happened. Now let's proceed to rollovers. Rollovers is a little bit different than transfers because a rollover is initiated by a distribution. Let's say an IRA holder goes, I'd like to take $10,000 out of my IRA. Okay, of course, a distribution will occur. An amount comes out of an IRA, $10,000. That $10,000 sits in the hands of the IRA holder. Now, the next question is there any guarantee that that person will put it back into the IRA? The answer is no. Therefore, that amount is, number one, reported to the IRS. There's going to be a 1099-R reporting that amount as taxable to the IRS. Now, the individual has a significant number of days to be able to put it back if they don't want to get taxed on that amount. That the number of days is 60 days. 60 days start from the day after that individual receives the funds. And that can mean many things. If the financial institution wired it, you'll get it sooner. But if they mailed it, well, then 60 days start from the day after you receive the check. So in other words, it's the IRA holder that keeps track of that distribution on when it was actually received. So keep good records. That amount that comes out must be put back in within 60 days. That's why, for the most part, if somebody was going to roll over assets that they previously distributed, the amount is typically going to come from their own checking account or cashier's check or whatever means that they took the cash and actually wants to put it back in the IRA. So therefore, the custodian receiving the rollover, in other words, the amount being put back, is going to ask some questions. They're going to go, whoa, where did this money come from? They're going to ask, has it been more than 60 days? Have you done more than one of these in a 12-month period? If you're over 17 and a half, and is any portion of this your required minimum distribution? Those are significant questions, and typically in the form of a form called a rollover certification form. So don't be surprised if you're going to do a rollover if the custodian asks you to complete a form before completing a rollover, because that certifies for them from the IRA holder that the amount is eligible to be put back in. Now keep in mind, there's two transactions, money coming out and then money coming back in, all right? The rollover does not have to occur within the same financial institution. It could be taken out of one financial institution and rolled over to another. So therefore, the other financial institution may not have a clue where that money's coming from. That's why they have to ask questions. A debit and a credit. As a matter of fact, the IRS handles that particular transaction on an individual's tax return on line 4A and 4B. If an amount was distributed, the IRS has put it on 4A. If the amount was rolled over, put the amount that's rolled over and write rollover beside 4B. Why is that? Because there will be a 1099-R and should be a 5498 offsetting, an IRS form 5498 offsetting that amount rolled over. If the two don't match, whatever the difference is the amount that's going to be subject to taxation. So make sure that the correct amount is rolled back in. That's a rollover. I'm going to extend the answer to your question. There's also another term called a direct rollover. A direct rollover means if it's coming from a 401k plan, a 403b plan, or a governmental 457b plan. If those assets come from those types of plans and it's being directly rolled into an IRA, it cannot be called a transfer because they're not like plans. So therefore, that amount is what we called a direct, or that transaction is what we call a direct rollover. There's a specific code for a direct rollover on the 1099-R that tells the IRS that this is not taxable. That code is a code G, if it's non-designated Roth assets, and it's a code H, if it's designated Roth assets being rolled over into a Roth. So it'll either be code G or code H. That's the difference between a distribution, a transfer, a rollover, and what we call a direct rollover. I hope that answers your question.
Next question. Does the K-1 I receive from limited partnerships invested in count as a FMV statement?
Does the K-1 from the An IRA invested in a limited partnership, and the partnership issued a K-1. The K-1 goes to the custodian for the partnership. Does the K-1 constitute the FMV? The answer would be yes, if there is any sort of FMV declared on the K-1. That's where the tax advisor comes into play. In some K-1s, there may be zero income. So there may not be a presumed amount or additional amount that has been earned by that partnership, but the original capital investment may still be there. So it really is up to the general partner to determine what the FMV is, outlined on the K-1 for the IRA to report as an FMV for the IRA. In other words, if you invested 10 grand, you still own a certain percentage of that partnership. Hopefully there's income from the partnership, right? So that's reported on the K-1. So it's up to the general partner. What is the ownership amount or the fair market value of that particular partnership ownership that is to be reported as an FMV on an IRA? If the income is larger, well, then it must be reported on the K-1. So the answer is generally yes.
Thank you. Next question. What is the process for in trust to determine my IRA FMV if my IRA owns an LLC that I control? Should I go ahead and send in trust the end 2020 LLC FMV or wait to be contacted?
The question is, what is the process for in trust to find out what the FMV of their LLC? We typically send out a letter by November 20th. Of a particular calendar year. So in other words, for 2021, you will receive a packet that says, what is the FMV of your investment? And then it's up to the general manager to provide that information to the interest group, or else we won't have a clue of what the fair market value would be of that LLC. And that's why we send out a statement requesting the FMV of an LLC that is owned by an IRA.
Thank you. Next question. What is the best/acceptable way to provide the required IRS valuation for a real estate asset held in my IRA with equity? Equity was capitalized, so I'm not sure if that was with another company or if you didn't mean to capitalize that, Michael. Continuing. The regulations are very vague, and since I'm not and won't be subject to distributions for several years, I do not wish to pay someone for a yearly evaluation. Will Zillow/realtor.com type evaluations work?
Well, here's the best practice that a lot of self-directed IRA administrators have come up with, given the fact that the IRS is pretty vague about fair market values. Let's start off with the most prudent way to get a fair market valuation in the event that there's a taxable event, such as if somebody's going to do a conversion or somebody's going to take a distribution of a retirement asset. The most prudent form of valuation would be getting an appraisal. Getting an appraisal will be the most prudent but expensive way to get a valuation of a particular asset, such as a piece of real estate. Now, in the event that all you're doing is providing a fair market value for reporting purposes, and you stated that there's no distributions that are going to be due for years to come, and all you're doing is providing a fair market value, we do have alternative forms of value that we would accept to provide to put it on an individual's statement, such as some of the most common ones are county valuations of a particular real estate asset. If it's only for reporting purposes, since the Congress is wanting to track what's in people's accounts that are alternative, line 12A and 12B of the, it's 12 or 15, 15A or 15B, 12A or 12A and 12B or 15A or 15B of the IRS 15498 requires the custodian or administrator to tell Congress what type of assets are held in an individual's accounts that do not have a readily determinable rate of return, such as real estate. since they're trying to put their arms around how much of these assets are being invested in those accounts, if it's just for that purpose, I would say a county bill for the property tax. Other forms of valuation could be a broker's evaluation of a piece of real estate based on certain comps within a particular area. We do send out a packet that says the acceptable other acceptable means that would be accepted by us as a custodian to report fair market value purposes only. But for taxation purposes, we would definitely require the most conservative approach, given the fact that we are responsible to report the accuracy of the taxation or the taxable event that occurred in the event of a distribution. But if it's not a distribution, there are other means that we would accept. And it is all stated on our fair market value request form for IRA holders that have a piece of real estate under their retirement plan.
Thank you. Next question. How does this relate to solo 401k plans?
How does it relate to solo 401k plans? Solo 401k plans have what we call employer contributions. It just so happens that in solo 401k plans, if you are a sole proprietor or a C corp, as an example, not a C corp, but sole proprietors or partnerships that have what we call self-employment income on line 14 in the K-1. If contributions are being made, those have to be made by the tax return due date plus extensions of the employer. In other words, your profit sharing and deferral contributions have certain deadlines, and that's what the significant deadlines were covered. If you're a solo 401k employer that has a solo 401k plan for 2020, or would like to establish a solo 401k plan for 2020, the deadline to make a contribution is the employer's tax return due date plus extensions. And those are the dates that we covered for this particular course.
Thank you. Next question. I live in a very rural area and have limited access to professional property managers. Assuming the person chosen is not a prohibited person, does the IRS permit a non-professional, non-licensed person to serve as my property manager for my rental real estate investment?
The IRS doesn't per se yes or no to your particular situation, because the IRS doesn't even vet out any investments or approve or disapprove of particular investments. The only thing that Congress has actually put in the Internal Revenue Code is that an individual should not engage with someone who is what we call a disqualified party, in which you've already mentioned that the individual that you are availing the services of is a non-disqualified party. Given the fact that there is no specific guidelines on who you could engage with to perform certain transactions, and as a matter of fact, you can pay that individual as well for the services they perform, you know, then that individual should be, you know, a potential candidate to perform certain ministerial duties on behalf of the IRA holder like you to avoid engaging in such a prohibited transaction.
Next question. I have IRA funds in a business account that is not an IRA administrator. How can I withdraw funds since the account will not issue a 1099-R or withhold the 10% for taxes?
I'm assuming that you're mentioning in this question is that an IRA invests in an LLC that has a checking account. If you would like to take a distribution from that checking account, that cash must come back to the IRA custodian, and the custodian will be the one to process the distribution directly to you. Because without sending that money back to the IRA custodian, you're correct. There will be no 1099-R or withholding, because they will not have any information in regards to the transaction that you just conducted. The IRA custodian is not privy to the information of the business in which an IRA may be invested in. So therefore, those assets must be reported back to the custodian to conduct the distribution properly. If not, there will be issues in the event of an audit from the IRS that assets were distributed without the knowledge of the custodian, and who knows what the IRS will, you know, react in regards to penalties and taxation that's associated with that particular transaction that, you know, did not go through the custodian.
Next question. Are real estate distributions to the SDIRA, but not taken by the beneficiary, included in FMV? In other words, is the FMV just the real estate assets in the account or undistributed distributions as well?
Income received by a piece of real estate owned by an IRA is included in the FMV. Think about it as if you bought a piece of stock in the stock market and dividends are paid. Rents and royalties are considered dividends when it comes to incomes received by a tax-exempt entity called an IRA. As a matter of fact, publication 598, it's either publication 598 or 568, that talks about the different types of incomes that are received by a tax-exempt entity that are not taxable to the entity. Rents, royalties, dividends, mineral rights. That income received by the piece of property is a dividend, and that amount is includable in the fair market value of the IRA. So in other words, it's not just the fair market value of the investment, it's also incomes that are received by that investment that constitutes the fair market value of the IRA.
Next question. Are transactions to or from Federal Thrift Savings Plan essentially treated the same as 401k? If not, what are the significant differences?
Federal Thrift Savings Plans could either fall on, anyway, let's just put it this way. Federal Thrift Savings Plans that fall under Section 401A of the code, and that would be a question that you would need to ask the plan administrator of that thrift savings plan. If a thrift savings plan falls under the Section 401A of the code, 401A of the code depicts qualified retirement plans. If a thrift savings plan falls under that section of the code, which would be depicted on the document, it'll be handled the same as a 401k plan when it comes to direct rollovers to an IRA.
Thank you. Next question. When determining reportable RMV, does the cash within the LLC checking account also get reported in the RMV?
When determining the required minimum distribution of an LLC owned by an IRA, is the cash included?
RMV. Sorry? They said RMV, not RMD.
Oh, I don't know what an RMV is. You're talking about a fair market value? FMV?
Otto, if you could please clarify if you meant FMV or RMD, JP can accurately answer that question you punched in. How about you go with RMD, JP, and if Otto corrects us, we can go with that.
Okay. If a person has an RMD and they have an IRA-owned LLC, the cash is included in the FMV to calculate the RMD for a particular year.
FMV. They just clarified.
FMV. Yeah, and the FMV, the cash in the account is also included. For IRA-owned LLCs, the cash is included in the FMV, should be included in the FMV of the IRA. Yes.
Thank you very much. Okay. Well, everyone, if you have any last minute questions you wanted to punch in, we will give you about 30 seconds here. We have reached the end of our Q&A. Thank you for some amazing questions, and thank you, JP. All right. Thank you, Chris. We have another question. Would the 60-day rollover rule apply to funds received in a checking account that are transferred to an IRA account as a result of a sale?
Okay, let me see if I understand your question. If an IRA has a piece of property and it's sold, and the proceeds hit a checking account. I'm assuming that the checking account is under an escrow company or under the IRA. Therefore, the IRA holder never received any sort of the money. In other words, they never had constructor receipt. Then there should be no distribution at all. Therefore, the 60-day rule doesn't even apply. However, if an IRA had a piece of property and it was sold, and then and the proceeds was accidentally deposited into an individual's IRA, an individual's own checking account instead of the IRA, that is considered a distribution. Therefore, a 1099-R must be issued to the IRA holder, and the IRA holder has 60 days to put it back into the IRA. I hope that was what your question was, and I try to approach it both scenarios, and I hope I answered that question for you.
Thank you very much. And then a little bit off topic, but Stephen was wondering, what is the enrollment for your CISP course? I said I'll provide some more information after the webinar as far as hard details, but JP, did you just want to talk about kind of our upcoming courses real quick in short?
Yeah, the CISP course is, again, what we call the Certified IRA Service Professional Designation that is designed for retirement plan industry professionals, specifically in the IRA world. The CISP has been around, over 15 years, going on 20 years, with the American Banking Association. I was a part of the original group that did the designation to the American Banking Association. When I moved to the interest group, I created a school to prepare individuals to take that particular exam. You don't have to take the exam, but it is a comprehensive operational as well as broad overview of the how to run a retirement program. We do have several programs occurring this year basically two sessions as we speak right now. One is a virtual session in May of this year, as well as one in September of this year currently designed as a live event. And that'll be held under the Tennessee Banking Association's location in Nashville, Tennessee, since we are a member of the Tennessee Banking Association as well, and our trust company is in Nashville, Tennessee. So if you want to attend this course, it'll be 3.5 days with the fourth day, a half a day as a review session for people who are going to be taking the exam. It's a very comprehensive overview of all the things you need to know to pass the test, as well as it's a, again, preparatory course for any retirement plan professional that wants to learn more about IRAs. We're also trying to create develop some additional courses that may be for consumers, such as, you know, understanding and maintaining your self-directed account. And those are still in the works. But I hope that answered your question in regards to CISP. We do have a landing page that's being developed right now so that it gives you a little bit more of information on the type of topics that will be covered for that particular course.
Excellent. Thank you, JP. Well, we have reached the end of our Q&A. So JP, if you want to take us home, that'd be great.
All right. Well, we thank you for attending today's course. Again, we appreciate your participation. We look forward to having you again in one of our webinars in the future. And thank you again for your continued business with the Entrust Group. Thank you.